Please come to order. I apologize to the audience, both listening and in person, that we are starting late. We had significant traffic issues for members getting in today. Ms. Birdsall, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Flores?
Here.
Board Member Goff?
Here.
Board Member Mastnack?
Here.
Board Member Rankin?
Here.
Board Member Shuffle?
Here.
Board Member Schroeder?
Here.
Chairman Dura?
Present. So a quorum is present, and all the members of the board are in attendance. So we'll proceed to item three, which is the Pledge of Allegiance. And Dr. Shuffle, would you, everybody please rise, and Dr. Shuffle will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
See, we will now proceed to, Now proceed to the approval of the agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda as published? Yes. Dr. Schroeder has moved that the agenda be approved. Is there a second?
I second.
It's been seconded by Dr. Flores. Is there objection to the adoption of the approval of the agenda? Seeing none, Ms. Birdsall, please record a unanimous vote in favor of approving the agenda. We now have item five, approval of the consent agenda. Dr. Schroeder, if you wouldn't mind proceeding.
I move to place the following matters on the consent agenda. 13.01, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license, charge number 2013-EC-612, to signify acceptance and approval of the terms and conditions of the settlement agreement by directing the commissioner to sign the agreement. 13.02, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning an application, charge number 2014-EC-1509, direct department staff to issue a notice of denial and appeal rights to the applicant pursuant to section 24-4-104 CRS. 13.03, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license, charge number 2014-EC-2245, to signify acceptance and approval of the terms and conditions of the settlement agreement by directing the commissioner to sign the agreement. 13.04, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning an application, charge number 2014-EC-2351, direct department staff to issue a notice of denial and appeal rights to the applicant pursuant to section 24-4-104 CRS. 13.05, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license, charge number 2014-EC-2395, direct department staff and state attorney general's office to prepare the documents necessary to request a formal hearing for the revocation of the holder's license pursuant to section 22-60.5-108 CRS. 13.06, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license, charge number 2015-EC-396, to signify acceptance and approval of the terms and conditions of the settlement agreement by directing the commissioner to sign the agreement. 13.07, regarding disciplinary proceedings concerning a license, charge number 2015-EC-1576, direct department staff and the state attorney general's office to prepare the documents necessary to request a formal hearing for the revocation of the holder's license pursuant to section 22-60.5-108 CRS. 13.08, approve two initial and one renewal request for an emergency authorization as set forth in the published agenda. 13.09, approve the University of Colorado Denver's request for culturally and linguistically diverse bilingual education endorsement program.
Can I just finish?
Sure. Thank you. 14.01, approve the Charter School Institute's request for waivers on behalf of Montessori Del Mundo as set forth in the published agenda. 14.02, approve the Charter School Institute's request for waivers on behalf of New American School Thornton as set forth in the published agenda. 14.03, approve the Charter School Institute's request for waivers on behalf of the Pinnacle Charter School as set forth in the published agenda. 14.04, approve the Charter School Institute's request for waivers on behalf of Salida Montessori Charter School as set forth in the published agenda. 14.05, approve Jefferson County's R1 request for waivers on behalf of Doral Academy of Colorado as set forth in the published agenda. 14.08, approve District 49's request for early college designation for Pikes Peak College as set forth in the published agenda. 15.01, approve the appointment of the Colorado Special Education Advisory Committee. Lindsay Applebaugh, Mark Chartier, Carissa Clinton, Nicole Dalek, Laurie Ditterlein, Lynn Fisher, Rebecca Hall, Chelsea Marks, Michelle Quackenbush, Lori Weehan, and Barbara Zayas as set forth in the published agenda. 16.01, approve expenditures for up to $80,000 from the Mary Jones Trust Fund for the Talking Book Library. This is the end of the consent agenda.
Thank you. Is there a second to that motion?
I'd like to add another one.
We need to second it first, and then
I second.
Okay, it has been seconded by Dr. Flores. Dr. Flores, do you have an addition or a deletion?
I have an addition.
Okay.
And that is 14.08. I wanted to ask questions about the culturally and linguistically, but I'm sure that passed muster. But I have questions about the Pikes Peak Early College, the El Paso County School District 49, and that's 14.08.
Do you want to pull that for a vote, or do you just have questions?
I have questions.
Do we have anybody who can?
Do you want to?
Staff who can answer?
From the staff can answer.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to do a little digging on that this morning. Gretchen Morgan, who would be able to answer that, is out today. I'll have to look out and see if I can get any questions. Maybe you and I can talk about your questions. I can make sure they get answered.
Okay.
Do you want to pull it for a vote later, or do you want to go ahead and approve it and then still ask questions?
Well, I want to ask some questions. There's some issues.
Right.
Big.
So, first of all, my question, do you want to pull this for a vote then? Pull it off the consent agenda?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. That's a proper request, and consent agenda requires unanimous consent, so that item 14.08 will be removed from the consent agenda. Is there a further motion? Yes. Ms. Rankin.
14.07, Eagle County School District, RE50. I would like that to be included in the consent agenda, taken off the vote.
Okay. That's a proper motion. Is there objection to the inclusion of 14.07 as a consent item? Okay, seeing none, 14.07 will be included in the consent agenda. Is there, we now have a motion and a second for the approval of the consent agenda as amended. Is there any objection to the adoption of that motion? It does require unanimous consent.
Dr. Flores mentioned another one. I don't know what we ended up doing with it.
Oh, for that one?
We took 14.08 off the consent. Oh, there was another
one. The other one, but that's okay.
13.09.
Yeah. Okay. She's okay with that.
Thank okay, you. Good. So, all right. So, So, as amended, is there objection to the consent agenda? Seeing none, the consent agenda is adopted. We'll proceed now to, Ms. Birdsall's report. Ms. Birdsall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Chairman Durham, members of the board, and Commissioner Crandall. As always, please speak clearly into your microphone. Be sure they are on and you are speaking. In your board packets, you have the following materials, your quick glance expense report and your event calendar. Also in your packets and or available on board docs are the following materials. 7.01, a copy of the data privacy bill, as well as the two adopted amendments to the bill, which is sitting on the bench before you. For 9.01, a memo regarding the school and district performance frameworks, targets, and weightings, and accompanying PowerPoint. For item 12.01, a memo regarding the Every Student Succeed Act, listening tour, and state development plan, and accompanying PowerPoint that is sitting on the bench before you. For item 3.08, you have a memo regarding the request for emergency authorizations for education personnel. For item 3.09, you have a memo regarding Colorado University's Devers request for culturally and linguistically diverse bilingual education endorsement program. For items 14.01 through 14.05, you have memos regarding the charter school waiver requests and additional supporting materials for each of those can be found on board docs. For item 14.06, you have a memo regarding Lewis Palmer School District 38's waiver request to waive 22.7.10.14 Rent 2A CRS, and additional supporting materials can be found on board docs. For item 14.07, you have the memo regarding Eagle County School District's RE50J's request for early college designation for Eagle County Early College High School East and West, and additional supporting materials can be found on board docs. For item 14.08, you have a memo regarding El Paso County School District 49's request for early college designation for Pikes Peak Early College. And again, additional supporting materials can be found on board docs. For item 14.09, you have the Student Reengagement Grant Program 2015-16 overview, the grant recommendation list, and accompanying PowerPoint. For item 15.01, you have a memo regarding the appointments to the Colorado Special Education Advisory Committee and their application packets. For item 16.01, you have an overview of the Mary Jones Trust Plan. For item 16.02, you have a memo regarding the notice of rulemaking for both rules, the operation of school transportation vehicles, which is 1 CCR 30126, and the annual inspection and preventative maintenance of school transportation vehicles, which is 1 CCR 30129, a copy of the redline rules for 1 CCR 30129, a copy of the draft rules combining the two rules, and a crosswalk linking transportation related statutes to the rules. For Thursday, for item 4.01, you have a memo regarding the CMAS COAL high school science and science PET scores sitting on the bench before you, and then the accompanying PowerPoint. For item 6.01, you have a memo regarding the rulemaking hearing for the bullying prevention and education grant program, a copy of the draft rules, a crosswalk of the statute draft rules, a letter jointly submitted by CASB, CRSA, in case, and CADB, sitting on the bench before you. And just so you know, we also received 144 comments submitted via online at Colorado form. And due to the volume of those comments, they're only available on board docs. And then we also have a response to written comments document, which is sitting on the bench before you.
Are they form?
It's a form that, they would go in and fill out. So that's why we only put it on board docs. That concludes my report.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Purcell? Thank you, Ms. Purcell. We'll now proceed to legislative matters. Mr. Crandall, do you want to start?
We do have with us Mr. Chair and members of the board, Jennifer Mello, who is our contract lobbyist. Had lots of conversations. It's been a very busy 1 month since the last board meeting, so very excited to hear her report. For the time of the meeting,
please join us.
Good morning, everyone. As always, it's nice to see you. The bulk of our conversation today will be about House Bill 1423, the Student Data Privacy Bill.
I don't think you're on.
She's on, but she's
just not on today.
Not close enough.
Or not close enough, one or the other.
Is that better? That better?
That's
Is that better? Okay.
There you go.
I find speaking with this thing in my face incredibly awkward, so I apologize if I accidentally run into it. So again, the bulk of our conversation today will be about House Bill 1423, the Student Data Privacy Bill. Before I do that, I just want to note a couple of quick things. First, the ongoing conversations between the Joint Budget Committee, the House and Senate Education Committees, had their last formal meeting this morning. Commissioner Crandall made a presentation. It was very well received. There was another presentation from an expert from the National Conference of State Legislators. As always, I will circulate copies of those to you as soon as I get them. And the Representative Rankin and Representative Hamner are proposing a piece of legislation out of that body of work that would essentially direct the legislative staff to work on these issues over the interim and prepare a report. Again, we will get you a copy of that draft bill as soon as I have a hard copy of it, but I need to get an electronic copy of it, and we'll send that out to you. It does require that those staff that work over at the Capitol consult with CDE staff. So there is a role at the staff level for CDE in that conversation, but it's primarily led by the legislative staff folks at the Joint Budget Committee, Ledge Council on Legislative Legal Services. Second other thing I wanted to note is there were two bills.
May I ask a question? I'm sorry.
Of course, Dr.
Is that regarding House Bill 1423, them talking together about that?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Flores, no, I'm going to get to House Bill 1423 in a moment.
Okay, but you're talking about the Rankin and the Hammer bill.
Yes, Dr. Flores, that has been proposed, has not been introduced yet, and that is an outgrowth of the school finance conversations that have been occurring at the Capitol over the last 3 months.
Thank you.
Of course.
Excuse me, I have a quick question, too. You said earlier that, I caught the tail end, that something required the legislators to consult with CDE. Did you say required?
Mr. Chair.
What did you say about that?
I have a bill draft right here, so let's just read it. In preparing the report required in this section, the Legislative Council staff shall work with the Department of Education, including taking into account information received by the department in preparing the state education plan. Now, I do think they're open to feedback on this draft. This has not been introduced yet. It was distributed as a draft for feedback. So we will get it to you electronically as quickly as we can. And again, if you have questions or comments, happy to try to facilitate that. So the next topic I wanted to discuss just briefly is there were two bills introduced late last night in the state Senate that relate to charter schools. Again, we will get those added to the chart as quickly as we can. They just got read across the desk around 8 o'clock last night. And we will discuss those at our legislative contact meeting next Wednesday. So just wanted you to know those are out there. We've got a plan for working them through our process. You may start hearing about those from your constituents.
Do you know anything about what they are about? Can you give us a snapshot?
I want to be careful here because I know from conversations in the building some components of them, but I wouldn't want you to take what I'm about to say as a comprehensive. So I know one of the issues that they're trying to deal with is how school districts share mill levy revenue with charter schools. I think that is a rather significant component of one of the bills. I think in broad terms, they're also trying to think through the accountability system for charter schools and just making sure that works. I don't, in no way, shape, or form, I think they're trying to suggest that charter schools should not be held accountable. I don't think that's what these bills are doing. But there was a word in there, accountability. When I see the bills, I'll have a chance to understand them better. So, and we'll get those out to you, again, as quickly as we can.
Thank you.
Of course. Things move very quickly this time of year, and so it's sometimes a little hard for all of us to stay on top of it. Okay, so House Bill 1423, Student Data Privacy Bill. The sponsors of this bill are Representative Alec Garnett, who is a Democrat from Denver, Representative Paul Lundeen, former State Board Chair, Republican from the kind of northern Colorado Springs area, I think would be a fair description of his district. Senator Owen Hill is the Senate sponsor of the bill. The bill was introduced about 10 days ago. It was heard in the House Education Committee on Monday. It passed unanimously. It was an 11 to nothing vote, which I have to tell you is rather extraordinary. There aren't a lot of bills on any topic that pass out of House Education unanimously. The hearing was relatively short, considering the passionate feelings that exist on this topic. It was about a two-hour hearing. Case testified in support of the bill, CASB testified in support of the bill, and then multiple parents testified in support of the bill, including Sherry Kiesecker, who I know is someone that's spoken to you all before. So all of those folks said that they support the legislation. They all said, of course, we might want a little tweak here and there. I mean, I would characterize this bill as one where nobody is perfectly happy. Everybody is pretty much happy and would prefer a few tweaks. Of course, the tweaks that one group wants would then be a problem for the other group. The Reps Lundeen and Garnett have done a truly remarkable job, in my opinion, of really working hard to create a balanced bill that is very tough in terms of protecting students' data and enhancing the privacy protections and existing law around that, but doesn't go so far as to stifle innovation, technology innovation that can be used to help student learning. That is admittedly a personal opinion, which probably has no place in this, but I just, having worked very closely with them at your direction, it's been really nice to watch them be incredibly thoughtful as they try to create balance to these issues. So, so that is kind of the big picture. The bill is next scheduled for a House floor vote. I anticipate that that could happen any day now. We only have 4 weeks left in session, so everything is going to be any day now. Once the bill passes the House, which I anticipate that it will move on to the Senate. There will be an Education Committee hearing there as well and a floor conversation there as well. So that's where the bill is in the process. I am happy to talk about kind of the overall structure of the bill. It's a long bill, and it's a fairly detailed bill. And I will do my best to answer any detailed questions you have about it. But I thought in terms of presenting it, it might be helpful just to focus on kind of the big picture structure so you can have some sense, I think, of what the legislators are trying to accomplish. I'm seeing nodding heads as if people think that would be helpful, so I'm going to proceed. So the bill has three major sections. The first deals with the Department of Education and the State Board of Education. As you all know, there is existing state law around data privacy issues for the Department of Education. That was a bill that the department worked on 2 years ago at the Capitol. So you all are actually the only entity right now that has any requirements under state law around student data privacy. This bill enhances those, strengthens those in a couple of different ways. One, it makes it very clear that you cannot, neither the board nor the department may enter into a new contract that would not be in compliance with these, with the provisions in the bill. If there is a material breach related to student data privacy of a contract, and I'm speaking now to the bill as it was amended in the House Education Committee. So if there's that material breach with student data privacy, there's two things that can happen. Either you all terminate immediately, or you all can have a board policy around termination that includes a public hearing about what happened and what the, you know, what the consequences are. So as introduced, it was just terminate the contract. As amended, it gives you, the state board, this applies also at the local level, but for the moment we're talking about state board, you all some ability to consider exactly what happened and to make a determination as to how to proceed with the contract. I think that's an important change that was made to the bill in committee on Monday. Additionally, the department would have to have an agreement with researchers by under statute. They'd have to do that, and those agreements, this is only in the realm of PII, of course, but so if you've got a researcher who's using PII, that researcher has to comply with all the same terms that are imposed on vendors, the primary one of which is you can't sell personal data. You have to destroy the data when it's no longer of use for the contract, those types of things. So your staff could speak better than I could to, I think the department had already been doing some of this around the research agreements, but this makes it required as a statutory matter that it's not just for vendor contracts the department and the board has, it is also for research agreements with individuals and institutions. And then the department right now is required to post vendor contracts on the website. This adds all of those research agreements, any data sharing agreements with other governmental entities, all of that now is required to be posted on the website. Again, I think that much of that is already happening based on your direction to the staff, but this puts it into statute. At a department staff level, the bill also does a couple of things. One, it requires that they provide sample contracts to school districts, so that the school districts can be in compliance with the law. Requires that they provide sample privacy policies to districts, because one of the requirements on the school folks is that they adopt privacy policies. And so this department would have the job of just providing a sample. I think the goal being to try to make that easier for school districts, at least give them a point of departure. There's nothing in the law that says they have to adopt the sample privacy policy. It's designed to be an assistance tool, not a detailed mandate. And then the department is also required to provide some training to school districts and their personnel around data privacy issues. So those are, I think, the significant changes I would highlight in terms of how the bill addresses State Board, CDE. All of the language in the bill about what local education providers, school districts need to do is brand new. There are currently nothing in statute about what school districts have to do as it relates to data privacy. So that's all new. There's similar requirements to what the state, what you all have been doing for a while. So they have to post on their website a list of all the data that they collect. They can only contract with providers that meet the privacy requirements contained in the legislation. The termination thing I explained to you for your all's contracts, same thing applies at the local level. One of the key things the bill does, and this is groundbreaking, no other state has looked at it this way, is it distinguishes between school service contract providers, which are essentially people that you have a contract with, be it the state board, the Department of Ed, or a district. So you enter into a contract with them to provide a service. So that's one category of providers. The other category is what they call on-demand service providers. And I can tell you in conversation what is meant by that term in a practical sense is apps, right? So we're talking there about apps that teachers may use in their classrooms. There's no contract, right, between the school district and that app. And by dividing those into two categories, the bill allows for some regulation of that app world that no other state has managed to accomplish to date. Every other state is simply not dealt with that issue. So thinking about the apps, school districts have to provide a list of the apps that are used in their district to parents. They have to do that twice a year. If a parent has evidence that there's a privacy problem with an app, right? If they have direct evidence that this app should not be being used because it's collecting a bunch of private data on my kid, there's a process where they can go to the school district and try to address that. If a school district ceases using an app because of privacy issues, they put that on their website. They also send that to the department, who puts it on their website. But one of the amendments that was added to the bill, I honestly forgotten when, but at some point, it allows that app designer, provider, creator to provide a response. Right? So it's designed to be kind of a neutral, just here's the information, nobody is investigating, nobody is judging. These folks made this determination, here's what the app provider says, and all that just is kind of out there for public information purposes. LAP's up. Yes, of course.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yeah, please, Mr.
Real fast question there. When does it trigger, how much, give us an example of a student using an app, when it would cross the threshold into PII territory as opposed to, there's an online calculator. What does the student have to put in that jumps it into that bucket?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, you're getting me a little out of my expertise. But here's the conversations that I've heard, right? So if you have an app that is collecting name and address, name and address are defined as PII in this bill. And then if the app is saying, you know, I mean, how many of us actually read those privacy policies whenever we buy an app? Most of us don't. But if that app says, and we have the right to sell that data, that app, were it to be regulated by this bill, would be in violation of this bill. So it's a little bit tricky, but essentially the parent could say, well, wait a minute, this is collecting PII, it's not using it consistent with how the bill would have it be used.
Jennifer, you can give me enough to...
Please.
This is so not how the real world operates. And so here's my big concern. Right. 99% of the time, the teacher has no idea what the apps are that are being used in that classroom. There are so many apps around. We were using one the other day around cut and paste of PDFs in a class I was in. That was an app, and you had to put in your email address to get to use this app. Does a teacher inadvertently get in trouble if they say, well, you know, there's several apps out there around PDFs, and the student goes to it, puts in their email address, gets it, and starts using it? Where's that line that, well, the teacher mentioned that there were, you know, a general category of PDFs for apps. I'm just worried that and this happens in legislation all the time, we, in the name of protection, actually create this incredible hindrance to technology, because that's not how the world works for apps. How do we make sure that we haven't, we have a conversation offline, but that's a little challenging there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. No. Commissioner, I think that those exact concerns were part of the dialogue. So nothing in the bill says teachers, the bill is absolutely silent as it relates to teachers being in trouble or anything like that or being disciplined. It really is about districts now kind of, I think, have to go look within and figure out how are we going to interact with our teachers to figure out what's being used in the classroom. And the testimony from the case representative was, I think, really interesting on this point, because what he said is, what we've realized over the last year or so is we probably need to get a better handle on this. Some of us would have done it anyway. This bill, of course, requires that we do that. And I think that's part of the soft touch. So it's not saying you can't use it. Nothing in this bill says you may not use this. But it's designed to bring some transparency to what is being used, and to give parents who have concerns about a particular app an avenue to express those concerns. Still, school district gets to decide what to do about it. So there's nothing that requires a school district to do anything in particular
just
about those complaints.
Just a quick follow-up then, Mr. Chair, to that. I guess my challenge is that's not the world of apps. Apps are created on the fly thousands every day. So to say to a school district, twice a year you must publish this list of apps, that's not even the real world that kids live in, that's even foreign to us. And trust me, as a guy with 13 kids, I'm learning about apps all the time, just trying to see what's going on there.
Do you have an app to track where your children are?
You have a birthday today?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. And I should have said, I would think that I've heard the sponsor say several times, like, this is Colorado's first attempt at this. This isn't going to be the last time we're going to have this conversation. Assuming this bill passes, there are going to be some unintended consequences that are going to have to come back and be fixed. And I think I am so not a technology person. I defer completely to your expertise on that. Like, I'm sure you're right. I defer to my 9-year-old's expertise on it as well, because she's a whiz at apps, and it makes me nervous, and I feel like I needed a class to help me figure out what she should have and not have. So, that's one of the places where the bill's trying to walk a line, and you all get to decide whether you think it's done so appropriately. But
I do like the bill. I meant to say that piece over there. Just
not floors.
I was at the hearing, and one of the things I heard was that anybody can bring up the app. Anybody, the parent, a child, a student, a teacher, the school district. Anybody can bring up, this is what this app is doing, and it's not, it's not conforming to statute. So it's up to everybody to bring this up if they find that an app is indeed not what it should be doing. In other words, selling information to other parties and such. So this has to be brought up by citizens and teachers and the school community and the community out at large.
I want to be sensitive to time, so Mr. Chair, maybe just I'll try to quickly finish describing what's in the bill, and then I... I'm sorry. I apologize.
So just listening to this conversation makes me wonder whether, in terms of the training ought not include the warning that if you're using an app or if your teacher is recommending a particular program, if they ask for PII, that perhaps that should be a flag. Just the fact that you're being asked, either a student is being asked to put in personal information or a teacher is putting in information about his or her students, mm-hmm. that's a kind of a flag that calls for either check with your technology person if you're in your school district if they have one, or that there's some sort of response to that becomes a trigger, as opposed to trying to look at this only from the outside
top down.
Mm-hmm. shouldn't we be training our kids and our staff that when they are inserting that kind of information, they ask themselves the question, why do I know that it's okay for me to do this? And if they don't have an answer to that, that they go in order to investigate further. It seems to me that that process might provide a whole different approach to how we do this.
Dr. Scheffel and then Dr. Flores.
So do we have time to keep discussing this, or are we trying to get through a number of
things? We'll make time.
Okay. Yep. So thanks for the presentation. So I wasn't able to be at the meeting, but I'm trying to follow the nuances of this legislation. Were there other amendments that were introduced that are being considered? That did you address those? Is that the
here?
Have you already addressed that?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Scheffel, I talked about, so there were two amendments that were out in committee, one of which clarified this issue around contract termination, both at the local level and the district level.
So there's a breach of privacy was that the
Correct. And I did email these to you all on, so you just, it's. I'm happy to describe them, but you do have them somewhere in your inboxes. The other thing the bill did is, in its original form, the bill said that if parents think that data about their kid is inaccurate, they could go to the vendor to correct it. The district said, we'd really much rather they come to us and we'll work with the vendor. And I think from a parent perspective, that makes more sense too, right? Like, as a parent, I know who my school and my district is. I may not know who the right person to call it, whatever vendor is. So I think that was a friendly amendment kind of from all sides. The other thing that it did is, so the bill, we haven't talked yet about the requirements on vendors. There's a bunch. We'll leave it at that for the moment. And then they apply both to the contractor and subcontractors. But I think it was accidentally in the drafting. If a vendor discovers a privacy problem with its subcontractor, there was no requirement to disclose. So they added that in, that if there's a subcontractor problem, the vendor had to disclose it, but it hadn't worked its way through the language, so that if a subcontractor makes a mistake, that also has to be disclosed. I'm just looking at these real quick. I think in terms of the agreement, the research agreements that the department may enter into with researchers, language was added around department shall implement the process subject to approval by the state board. So the department's going to come up with some process on that and then bring that to you all as their bosses. I was trying to think of a better word, and all I could think of was overseers, which seemed worse than bosses.
Dr. Flores.
Wait, I'm not finished.
I'm sorry. Yes, please proceed.
So is it the case that the way the proposed legislation is currently written, that PII still can be shared with out-of-state databases without parental consent? I think that's something I'm hearing, that it doesn't preclude that.
It does preclude that, I think.
I don't think it does.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Scheffel, I don't want to give you an... I want to get you the right answer, and I'm afraid that if I do it off the top of my head, it won't be right. So may I seek an answer to that question for you and get back with you on that?
Right, and then I had another question about the IRB. So right now, it's a contract with the state. The IRB, in terms of an entity doing research with data at CDE, and the state is... The burden of the IRB is on the entity, but CDE doesn't have an IRB. Is there discussion to add that back in? I mean, that gives us a stronger vehicle as a board to review and oversee research that's being conducted with data at the state, as opposed to the contract. The IRB process is very different. Is there any appetite for that language?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Scheffel, I think that has been a conversation. So the bill does talk about IRBs in the context of research by higher education institutions. And essentially it says that if a researcher has gone through that process, that is deemed sufficient to substitute for some of the other requirements, for the requirements the bill in general imposes on researchers. I think the thinking being that those are, I don't know which is, if one is better, they're at least equivalent, perhaps one is even better than the others, I don't know.
You mean a contract versus an IRB?
Correct.
Yeah, they're really not equivalent at all.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm just wondering if anybody had surfaced some of those arguments.
I mean, I think that that's been a topic of conversation. My understanding is there's not any plans to change the current language in the bill, that as it stands, individual researchers, other researchers who go with the department have to do an agreement, and they are subject to all of these terms. The IRB only comes into play in the bill when it has to do with higher education research.
Okay, and then finally, just to comment on the commissioner's comment, I think as I read the bill, the onus of the on-demand providers in the bill is put on the vendors to comply, not on the teachers. So when we talk about, you know, this isn't reality or whatever, the onus is on the vendor, not the teacher, to go and scurry around and figure out how this compliance is going to be addressed.
I'm next.
So I think, and rightfully so.
I think you may be right, but the challenge is the vendor of an app is a 13-year-old kid living in Uzbekistan who posted it to a, you know, to the Google Play Store. And so what do we, how realistic is this? And this has nothing to do with that. I mean, this is, I understand what we're trying to accomplish here. I wonder if the language needs to be reworded a little
but
bit.
To the extent that even a login is PII, and that PII data can be shared out of state without parental consent, then individuals who develop apps that are used in public schools need to be more responsive and responsible with the kind of data they're collecting and where it goes. So I get it that kids develop apps, but I'm just saying that this is a public entity, and, you know, when we have data being used for various purposes, I think we have to, you know, be diligent in how it's used and where the onus is. So that was my point.
Dr. Flores?
So one of the things that I know, they were talking about that this was not going to cost money, but I think it's going to cost money. I mean, if you're going to train teachers, and if the state is going to be responsible according to what the legislation says, then there should be monies attached for the department and for the training. I mean, there's monies out there, and yet it went off as there's no cost, and there is cost. And suppose somebody wants, I mean, I was just thinking, according to how it's written, people could ask, I just want to, you know, I want the department to come out here and really train the people because we're really concerned about this. And I think that seriously needs to be looked at because we're already, I mean, I think the department may not have the resources kind of in that area, and that needs to be looked at.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Flores, I think there was some interesting testimony to that point that came from the school district representative talking about, because the bill does not come with additional resources, there was going to be a need for patience, that because both school districts and the department would be implementing this within current resources, that, you know, none of this would happen overnight. And I understand your point, and so I just want to make your colleagues aware that's how that topic was discussed in the hearing. I think it's also important to note that when the department prepared its fiscal note, it listed some assumptions that relate to this, and that is that the training that they're being asked to provide under this bill is consistent with what they're already planning to do based on Commissioner Crandall's direction. So if that assumption were to not be true, I think the one could refer back to that fiscal note in the future and say, we're getting much, much more requests, and then have that conversation through the budget process. So that's, I think, how the fiscal issues have been addressed today.
Thank you. I think, Ms. Mello, I've observed that I think probably the legal and the practical cutting line on this is if the teacher says, I suggest that, or insist, depending on whatever the language is, that you use App X, I think there's some responsibility that accrues to the district, and they should be cognizant of what's going on and careful about monitoring what's going on. And there's simply no way to prevent a student from accessing whatever app they want. It's not, and frankly, that's an issue between the parent and the student, and not the state and the student. And I don't know how we would involve ourselves in that. So I think the practical side of the bill is pretty simple. If the district's or its representative is involved in pushing something, they're going to end up with some level of responsibility.
Mr. Chair,
that's where the training comes. Dr. Flores.
I think there was mention that parents have to be trained as well. So the legislation assures, you know, districts that the district is responsible, I think, for training the parents, and the department is responsible for training the district. So there's a chain there, and I think monies are going to be much more than zero.
Thank you. Ms. Mello, any other?
Well, I serve at your pleasure. I have yet to describe the vendor requirements in the bill. Would that be helpful?
I think that would. Yes.
Okay. All right. So I'll try to do that as quick as I can. So now, everything I'm talking about right now relates to school service contract providers, so the folks that there's a contract with. So we're not talking about the apps right now. I just want to be clear about that. So they have to provide information about the types of PII that they collect and the learning purpose for that information. The way the bill is structured is they provide that to the district that then puts it on their website. Again, because parents want to go to the district website. They don't want to have to find some vendor website. But the onus is on the vendor to prepare that in a form that ideally the school district just, they probably do more than copy and paste. Again, I'm no technology expert, but something equivalent to copy and paste to put it up on their website. School service contract providers may collect, use, and share student PII only for purposes authorized in a contract or with the consent of the student or student's parents. School service contract providers may not sell student PII, use or share student PII for purposes of targeted advertising to students, or use student PII to create a personal profile of a student other than for supporting purposes that are addressed in the contract. There are a few exceptions to that. So if they get a court order, they have to disclose. We did get some language inserted into an earlier draft of the bill based on some great feedback from Board Member Rankin that if that PII does have to be disclosed in a judicial context, the parent should get notified about that. So that's in the bill. School service providers have to maintain a comprehensive information security program. They shall destroy student PII within the time period specified in the contract or at the point where that data is, the purpose of the contract has been fulfilled. So there's a data destruction requirement in the bill. So those are, I mean, I'm giving you the highlights, but those are essentially the requirements around vendors and researchers. Remember, because at the beginning of the bill, it talks about researchers working with the department have to comply with all of those things as well. So the only group that testified on Monday but that did not support the bill. Now, they testified in an amending position, which is a soft oppose. That's my interpretation. That's not what they said, but that would be my interpretation of what amending means, was the Software Industry Association. So the technology folks have some concerns that they think this bill goes too far. They don't like that the definition of PII is different from other states because it's easier for them, understandably. I mean, I get it, right? If I'm running an operation in 30 states, I'd rather have the rules be the same. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but I know that the legislators who crafted this were very thoughtful about the definition of student PII and aren't particularly interested in changing it just to make it easier for other folks. So that's... I think a decent overview of the bill, and I'm happy to continue the answer questions or dialogue.
Further questions about House Bill 1423? Yes, Ms. Goff?
Yeah, thank you. I don't really have a question. I guess more of a comment that it could be a question. The issue about the elimination of or termination of contract, and we had talked a little bit about that when we first got the bill. Mm-hmm. But some clarification about the prerogatives that either the state, the department, or a district has when we're using termination of contract. I didn't discern. I can look again, of course, but any real clarity about immediate versus after a period of time where there's a review of the case, and I'm thinking ahead, and the other kind of tied in with that is the fact that if this law should pass, probably will in some form, guess who gets it to do rules? So we're going to have plenty of opportunity to really process through all of this. But I think from the get-go, some clarity about the termination. We don't need to think about the aftermath or how the bill ends up. Whether or not, how do we determine, I mean, we're going to have to set some kind of some parameters for what is a breach, I guess. And how do we know that? And how many of those will we have in a year's time? I'm looking on the optimistic side. Is it how many, and what does constitute grounds, how many people, for example, need to draw it to somebody's attention before it becomes, you know, when it becomes a viable case of breach? I'm just concerned.
A breach is a breach, I think.
Well, but yes, but I think we're going to have some sort of characteristics of it. Or what is this breach? If it's just PII, one student's PII, I don't know. I mean, I do support this bill. I think it's a great start. I do understand and identify with those who are seeing, the what ifs and the unintended consequences. But I just want us to be prepared for that because this is brand new in many, many ways. Not all ways, but many ways. So
I would just note that there's case law that I think will inform the definition of material breach. If and when this bill becomes law, I think your counsel over there, you might want to have some conversations about how to inform that.
Okay.
And the Attorney General's Full Employment Act, so.
May I?
Yes, Ms. Goff.
Always something to do, right? Legislative Legal Services and your department and others, have we had any indication that there's problems, shaky ground, new territory, possible
minefields,
pitfalls, all those words?
We've expressed some concern about the effect of the notice requirement and that there's no opportunity for a hearing before a vendor who has breached an agreement has their name posted, and how to deal with that. The response to that was to add language to the bill to say that when the vendor's name is posted, it must be posted with a response by the vendor should the vendor choose to include one. If the final version of the bill, if the feeling is that it proves insufficient, I think that perhaps we could look at additional policies that would comport with due process that could be that could be done by the department or the state board.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
So the
go right ahead.
The vendor's posting would be at whichever level there's a problem. So in other words, CDE, if we have a problem with some vendor, then we need to post a response on, it's at a state level. If a district has a problem with a vendor, then
I want to make sure that we're clear about what we're talking about here, because this only relates to on-demand providers, right? So this is not about contract providers. That part of the bill only relates to on-demand providers. And if a district stops using it for privacy reasons, they put it on their own website. They then send that information to the department that is also required to put it on its website, okay, along with the response. So I just want to make sure
that's
we have
important.
The factual context there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Any further discussion of House Bill 1423? Seeing none, is there a motion on House Bill 1423? Yes, Ms. Goff.
I move that the board adopt a position of support for House Bill 1423.
That's a proper motion. Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded. Dr. Schroeder has seconded. Is there objection to the adoption of that motion? Seeing none, that motion is adopted by a vote of 7-0. Ms. Mello, if you would communicate that to the sponsors and, when appropriate, to members of the General Assembly, we would appreciate it.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you all. We'll see you soon,
I would imagine. Okay. All right. Now we will move to item 8, public comment. Ms. Bertzel, do we have a sign-up sheet handy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to let you all know that
here. I can't make it work, so I broke one lever trying.
Do we have one? Sorry.
Tell us.
Which way do you want to go, up or down?
Just a quick update. The bill is being debated on the House floor right now. So it's up for second reading right now. So I'm going to hustle across the street and make sure to let them know about your position.
Thank you.
Yeah, there are two.
I'll tell them.
Does that work?
I don't know.
feel like I'm supposed to. Oh, there we go. Got it.
All right.
We're
a little behind time, but with any luck, we'll catch up here. Let's start. Yes, Ms. Gull.
I just wanted to share with you that Ms. Mello, on her way out the aisle, told us that they're hearing the bill right now on
right.
the floor. So she's going.
Yep. So still maybe in the Senate by the time we get to tell anybody.
Yeah, like by 10:30.
Yeah, by 10:30. Let's start with Cindy Loveland. Ms. Loveland. And just a reminder, Ms. Bursa will keep time for everyone. You have 3 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Cindy Loveland. I live in Jefferson County in the 7th Congressional District. I appreciate the opportunity to bring some concerns to you today. I've been to a lot of Jefferson County School Board meetings, but this is the first time I've ever come before the State Board, so I appreciate that you allow this comment. The concerns that I want to bring to you today are about two bills, one that was passed in 2014, and that one was House Bill 1288, and another one that's currently laid over in the House, House Bill 1164. House Bill 1288 that passed in 2014 requires schools to make the immunization and exemption information to vaccination of their enrolled students publicly available on request. It also requires CDPHE, in consultation with other state departments, to establish a joint policy on the immunization data collection and sharing. I haven't been able to see a copy of that joint policy, if there even is one. I'm not sure if there is. So I'm hoping that maybe somebody could let me know if there is one and where I could get a copy of that. While the Department of Education isn't specifically named, I just assume that because this is a state issue, a state bill, it's going to apply to every single school in the state, that there would be some sort of a collaboration or policy. The current bill that is laid over in the House for second reading proposes to force parents who have chosen to exercise their legal right to exempt or delay one or more of the vaccines required for school to submit their medical, religious, or personal belief exemption directly to CDPHE. That record would then be put into either the current immunization tracking system or in a separate state-run centralized database. Current state law requires schools to collect a certificate of immunization for every student enrolled, and this is the way it's been done since 1979. These immunization records are considered educational records and are protected by FERPA. House Bill 1164 would circumvent FERPA, which would require written consent before the school would share that record with the state health department. Parents have the expectation that their child's school records are private. If CDPHE moves forward with this new online system, parents need to be fully informed that they will be giving up their privacy protection provided by FERPA. That communication would need to come through the schools because that's a FERPA issue, and CDPHE doesn't have to comply with that. finally, I just want to say there's a lot of confusion on this issue, and I think it would be helpful, since it's a state issue that affects every school, that maybe CDE could provide some clear and accurate information on this. We're already hearing from parents that they're getting letters already stating that they
must
Loveland, file
your
their
time
exemptions.
Has expired. Could you
okay.
Wrap it up, please?
I want to also just give you some information about the organization that I'm with. I have a copy for all of you. It's geared towards legislators, but it's good for anybody that has to look at policy.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Melissa Weinfeld. Thank you.
I'll wait until she's done passing this out. Good morning. I am coming to you this morning as a mother with concerns regarding House Bill 1164 and even the implementation of this new program through CDPHE and CDE, even if this legislation does not pass. I would really like to note first that everyone I've been in contact with at CDE so far has been nothing but kind and respectful. I feel the need to recognize this because you're going to hear great frustration in my voice and from other parents probably. And I just want everyone here to understand it's not directed at anyone at CDE specifically. I am a mother trying to protect my family, my rights, and for months have been passed from office to office. So please understand why we are so upset and coming here now to you to express these concerns. I sent an email yesterday with concerns and asked that it be forwarded to Dr. Schroeder because she is my, we were in Jefferson County Schools. I don't know if you were forwarded that. Because I did not receive a response. Instead, I received a reply from Ms. Sarah Matthews that did not address one of my concerns. She recommended that I contact Diana Herrero at CDPHE. The Governor's Office of Constituent Services has recommended I contact CDPHE. The Attorney General's Office has recommended I contact CDPHE. Legislators have they are misleading legislators. They're the problem. CDPHE is the problem. Why would I contact CDPHE? We are not getting anywhere with CDPHE. They are the ones who are running out of control trying to implement a new program outside of legislative authority. They are misleading school districts, health and wellness coordinators, school nurses, and even legislators. CDPHE has been rolling out this information for months while the legislation is currently stalled in the House. There's an incredible amount of confusion among school districts and child care facilities and school nurses. CDPHE claims that even if 1164 does not pass, there will remain the option for parents to go online to file their vaccine exemptions, which, let me be clear, is only for parents who file exemptions for their children. This is not if you get vaccinated and you still get the freedom to turn your records into school every fall. It's only discriminating against a small group of families who choose to file or have medical exemptions for their children. We're gonna harass you and pick you out and treat you as a second-class citizenship, and we're gonna make you go directly online to the state where we're gonna track your children's information. And then we're gonna follow up with reminder recalls. Well, hey, there are new forms. Are you aware of these new forms with this incriminating statement on it that says, as a parent who is foregoing the recommendations of a physician, that I'm putting my child and myself at risk by not getting them vaccinated? That's compelled speech. No parent's going to sign that new exemption form. So how is CDPHE going to get anybody to go online to fill out these forms anyway? And do you all know that there is a separate database at CDPHE? Even if you opt your child out of CIIS, when you go and file your exemption forms online, your information, and this came from Megan Berry at CDPHE, you can double check this information with them. All that information is going to go into a separate internal database to CDPHE first, and then if you choose to opt out of CIIS, she simply won't pass that information along to CIIS. As a mother, I do not know where to go anymore. The problem is that once this information is taken out of schools, we lose FERPA protection. I don't think the state has any business getting involved with stripping me of my federal rights. I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Long, or Ms. Winfield, I'm sorry. Pam Long.
Hello, my name is Pam Long, and I'm from Douglas County.
Please speak up a little bit, if you would, Ms. Long, please.
Can you hear me now?
A little louder.
Can you hear me now? I feel like I'm yelling at you.
Yeah, we get yelled at a lot, so it's okay.
All right, one more try.
There we go.
Okay, my name is Pam Long. I'm a parent from Douglas County, and I have shared some of my concerns over the past week with members of the board. I also have a son with vaccine-induced brain injury. I know that might come as a surprise to you, but pharmaceutical products and vaccines, they do sometimes have adverse effects. So I want to, I'll skip over some of the parts that we already talked about, but CDPHE is not being transparent with school districts and school nurses, and it is acting beyond its legislative authority in a way that is currently directing schools to violate FERPA. House Bill 1288, a 2014 law, directs schools to violate FERPA by uploading all philosophical and religious vaccine exemptions with PII to their database, which is known as CIS or CIIS. And since 2014, the CDPG has not been able to resolve this violation of FERPA problem discussed in all of their quarterly stakeholder meetings, many of which I have attended. It is technically true, if you talk to CDPG, they will tell you they are not violating FERPA because that state office falls under HIPAA. However, they have directed schools to share PII, which is a direct violation of FERPA. And I could read you the part, the paragraph from the 2016 state audit of CDPHE that directly says they are in violation of FERPA. Well, they're directing schools to violate FERPA. But for the sake of time, unless you ask me to, I'll skip over that and go on to my next point. Because CDPHE could not resolve the FERPA violation, they proposed this bill this year to House Bill 161164 to seize control of all school immunization records from schools, which would then lose all their FERPA protections and now fall under HIPAA. This bill is not law. However, CDP is acting like it is signed into law. They are sending postcards, this came up in House testimony, to families, directing school nurses to post on their school websites that the vaccine exemption process is changing to an online-only process controlled by CDPHE in July 2016. And the frustration you are going to hear from parents is, will schools protect our rights, ensuring that school staffs give correct information that this online system is voluntary? It is not mandatory. It is not current law. Will CDE ensure that school staffs inform parents that they have the right to opt out? And I'll finish up. Thank you. Will CDE explain to parents that if you submit your medical records directly to CDPHE, you forfeit your rights under FERPA? So in conclusion, the statutes are clear that each school has authority over school immunization records, not CDPHE. And yet both CDE offices, Data Privacy and Wellness, that have been communicating with me graciously, have been led to believe that they cannot challenge the directives of CDPHE, even when privacy is being violated and misinformation is being disseminated. If you have any questions, I welcome them. I've been working on this issue to protect vaccine exemptions for families in Colorado for 10 years.
Thank you, Ms. Long. Deborah Cole.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good morning. At the end of the last school year, Colorado families were happy to learn that the amount of standardized testing imposed under the new Common Core Aligned regimen would be reduced. The PAR Consortium announced that the total length of assessments in each grade would be decreased by 90 minutes. A careful comparison between last year and this year reveals that the cheering was premature. If you look at the charts I've distributed, you will see that the total testing time allocated for third grade math last year, for example, was 300 minutes, while for this year it is 240 minutes. That seems to be a true reduction, until you look at the small print. The 300-minute figure for last year is the total for time and a half, which is required for students with special needs. Last year, as it happens, time and a half was made available to all students, those with and without required accommodations, who were tested together indiscriminately. In practice, at our elementary schools, almost all the students without a special needs designation truly did complete these assessments in two-thirds of the available time. Hence, the typical average student would have finished in 200 minutes. Compare 200 minutes to 240 minutes, which is the total for the current year, minus extended time. that is the true comparison that should be made. And there's something else. Both the test administration manual and the PARC website state the testing window for paper and pencil testing is a maximum of 30 school days. The District of Columbia, for example, has a paper and pencil window running from March 28th to April 29th. Maryland and New Jersey give the maximum of 6 weeks, and Massachusetts allows testing between April 25th and May 27th. Why did CDE feel it necessary to force schools opting for paper and pencil to complete all testing between April 11th and April 29th? Once again, to take third grade as an example, these young students are having to sit for math tests for 4 straight days for a total of 240 minutes, and after a break of a few days for another 3 straight days of ELA testing, totaling 255 minutes. They're permitted a 3-minute break during a testing session. Special needs students are being assessed for 360 minutes over the first 4 days for math and 283 minutes for 3 days of ELA testing. A gratuitous and unnecessary strain is being placed on our youngest students and our most vulnerable students. Colorado's families should be asking why. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cohen. Ms. Leeds? Ms. Leeds in the room? LEDS? Sorry. It's what? Oh, it's an O and not a D.
Yeah.
Sorry. I will get my glasses checked.
It's
I apologize. Okay.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Blanca Leos. Having a bullying prevention program is crucial for our schools. It gives school staff the tools to be better equipped to intervene and assist students when incidents of bullying occurs. Bullying prevention programs create and sustain a positive school culture where students feel connected to their schools, and also gives parents a sense of relief knowing that our schools are taking the steps to prevent our children from being targeted simply for being who they are. It ensures that students have caring, safe, and respectful space for them to learn in. I know for me, it would have came in handy when my child was getting bullied for being different. He was in the eighth grade when students began to bully him at school. For him, just calling him names, just simply because he didn't like sports, he liked girly things, and acted gay. He was called names and was getting picked on. This affected him in many ways. He battled with depression, contemplated suicide, and at one point wanted to drop out. It made it very difficult for his dad and I, because my son has always been an overachiever and a straight A student. But when you hear your kid say, "Mom, I hate school," you feel your heart tear apart. Although he told several of his teachers about it, and was telling them what was going on, including the principal, it didn't prevent it from happening. And at one point, it made it very difficult and worse for him. Being bullied at school made it very difficult for him to learn, grow, and be himself. I'm here today to speak on behalf of those parents who struggle with this every day and who have similar experiences with their children. As parents, we want to feel that the school system is doing all they can to keep our children safe and prevent any harm to our children, both physically and emotionally. If we team up together, we will have the ability to do something about it and prevent children like mine to endure these types of issues and even prevent suicide. This prevention program will give parents like me the opportunity to work with schools to create and implement bullying prevention strategies, stay involved, and help put the end to bullying. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Leos. Sarah Sampaio.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Sampaio. I am here as a parent,
Although I am a school board member, I am not speaking on behalf of our school board, but rather the constituents and like-minded parents who elected me. I would like to speak about the use of standardized testing as a venue to collect survey-type data on our children. The matter of standardized testing has evolved from an interest in promoting education to an interest in promoting political agendas. When one has knowledge of the history of how standardized testing has been evolving, it is apparent. Mandatory participation in standardized state-required testing should not be used as a license to a data pool population without the informed consent and knowledge of the parents as to what they're collecting and the use of it. Last year, there were numerous reports of questions on standardized tests that required a student to access their personal political values or religious or family beliefs in order to answer the questions. I argued that such questions are inappropriate, number one, because they were forbidden by the then current federal law, and number two, because who determines the right answer? This begs the question of why are such questions on this test? The state has no right to be measuring our children according to these religious, family, or political beliefs. I am now hearing reports of pretest survey data that accompanies the standardized test. We as parents should have the right to be informed and refuse participation in such survey type information gathering. Currently, only the minor children are being informed and instructed. I would respectfully ask that the state board implement an instruction that the test proctors administering the test should be instructing children that they are not required to answer questions that ask them to reveal their personal attitudes, values, or beliefs. I respectfully request that we ensure by way of policy that our schools recognize and respect the primacy of the rights of the parents in the parent-child relationship, especially regarding the privacy and the role of the parent in the matter of attitudes, values, and beliefs, and that survey-type questions be required to have the informed consent of the parents before the kids are invited to participate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Sampaio. Ray Trout.
My name is Ray Trout. I was not prepared to say anything, so I'll try to be brief.
Excuse me, we are able to hear him very well. So
speak up just a little, if you would.
Yes, once an engineer, but I've been working this past year on a process of light assessment that I hope can take the place of serious over-testing. I was at the meeting yesterday at the Capitol on the privacy issue. I think that was good. But I think the default in the personal information should be that the personal information that does not leave the school. That should be the default. Windows 10 installed it on my computer the other night without my permission or desire. And it took me half an hour to block all of the ways that a youngster might grab as the easy default, an open window to an endless number of vendors being able to pull whatever they wish from my computer and surely the computers of young people. I think that's the wrong way to structure a default. The firewalls in the legislation, as far as I can tell, has to do with contract language. The possibility of maybe a curtailment of a contract. The language should be discussing serious prison time for violations, in my opinion. That should be the default, not potential cancellation of some business. The way it's set up, as far as I can tell, I'm not expert, but it seems like it's going to put mothers against a very large, powerful industry. And that's another default that needs to be turned upside down. That's as much as I can say right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trout. Thank those who participated in sticking to the time. I'm just going to exercise a little discretion here. By way of disclosure, the 1979 amendment on the personal exemption, if my memory serves me correctly, was one that I carried as a member of the legislature and put into the law, so I have a little stronger feeling in favor of personal exemptions than perhaps most. And I would ask Mr. Dill to review whether or not school districts are obligated without additional statutory change to comply with requests, these requests from Colorado Department of Health, and if they are not, to propose a notice that we might send to them reminding them of their obligations under the law to keep that private. So, and I'm sure that'll be controversial within your own department, Mr. Dill, and I presume you will exercise appropriate fiduciary's duty for us. I think that the department should not be assisting, nor should school districts be assisting, unless they're compelled by state law to do so. And if they are, I hate to suggest that the parents need to go someplace else, but it is more appropriately taken up across the street than here, unfortunately. The park exams, could we have these time frames reviewed and the survey question issue especially have that reviewed? I would appreciate it.
Excuse me.
Yes, Ms. Masley.
Ms. Sampaio is here. Didn't we have this issue discussed last year there was a survey at the end of? Is that the same thing you're talking about? This is different?
I think
okay, we'll talk to you afterwards to get more
details. Not here, but those were discussed last year, Ms. Masnick, and I think there was a general denial that that took place, but who knows?
Well, it was up to districts.
Yeah. So, all right. Thank you. Why don't we take a five-minute recess, and then we'll start with item 9. Okay. 5 minutes. Try and keep 5 minutes if we can. Thank you.